The Bob Murphy Show, episode 320.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. This episode I'm going to be speaking with Professor Michael Humer, who's a professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado. So he got his PhD in philosophy at Rutgers, and he is the author of more than 80 academic articles in epistemology, ethics, metaphysics, and political philosophy. And he's also the author of 10 books, which on his author bio, he says they're amazing and you should immediately buy them. So there you go. Joking aside, I've known about Professor Humer for a while now, in particular back when I was more deeply ensconced in online economics stuff. Brian Kaplan used to blog about Humer a lot. So he's an anarcho-capitalist, but it's interesting because he's coming at it through philosophy as opposed to economics, which is, as you folks probably know if you listen to this podcast, you know, with Rothbard and David Friedman, like it's usually an economics frontal assault, and then, oh, and then here, let's backfill the philosophy, whereas Humer, it's, he starts out with the philosophy. So specifically, the focus of our conversation is his book called The Problem of Political Authority. And so I don't need to dwell on the conversation anymore at this point, since it's pretty self-explanatory. I just want to mention one of the supporters of the Bob Murphy Show contacted me recently and said, hey, I really think that this guy Humer, you know, he's an ANCAP, but he comes at stuff from a different angle, so why don't you try to get him on it? So I'm very open to your suggestions, so please keep them coming. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Professor Michael Humer. Mike, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So, again, as I will have explained in the little short introduction that I would have pre-recorded for this, the reason for your busy, I've heard of you and known about you for years, particularly through Brian Kaplan's blogging about your stuff. And then finally I had some of the supporters of this show emailing me saying, you got to get this guy on because he's got an interesting take on problems of political institutions that is not just exactly the same thing.
As, it's true. You have very smart listeners.
Yes, clearly. Very good taste. So why don't we start with this? So just so you know, so with my show, I'm coming from the Rothbardian tradition, so you know my viewers are very familiar with anarcho-capitalism, stuff like that. And so, you know, so first of all, your book's The Problem of Political Authority. Yeah, do you want to just stop, you know, give a sort of a, and there it is, what a handsome volume. Give a you know, an overview of what you're trying to do with that book, and then maybe we'll start drilling down into some specifics.
Yeah. So I called it The Problem of Political Authority, because there's a fundamental philosophical problem in political philosophy, which is what is the basis for the authority of the state? Mm-hmm. Right now, you know, when I say the authority of the state, well, the authority is a hypothesized moral property that the state would have that would explain why they're entitled to do things that would be wrong if anyone else were to do them. Mm-hmm. So, like, if I decide to go out and tax people, they call that extortion, and I would be sent to prison by the state, by the way. But moreover, almost everyone would consider that that is unacceptable behavior. Okay. Even if I'm, you know, taking the money for a good cause, like if I decide to just like steal people's money and then I give it to charity, that's still considered wrong. Okay. Or, you know, if I decide that there's another country that's posing a threat and I'm going to just go over there and start blowing up buildings and shooting people, they would call me a terrorist, and that would be considered very wrong. And the state, by the way, would also consider it wrong. They would put me in jail, but they're doing the same things. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So why is it okay for them to do these things and not us? Right. And the answer to that is they have authority and I don't have any authority. Okay, but so the philosophical problem is, well, why do they have authority, right? And now, you know, just to be clear, there's a distinction between having power and having authority. Having power is the ability to make other people do what you want, you know, the ability to force other people to obey your will. And authority is having the moral right to do that. Okay, so why do they get to do all these things? And basically, so in the book, I just go through theories that people would advance about why the state has authority. Well, it turns out that none of them are good, right? Mm-hmm. There is no good answer to this question. And so my conclusion is, well, maybe they don't have authority. They don't have authority. It's just an illusion that we're all under, right? And, you know, and I spend a little time talking about why we're under this illusion, just the psychological factors that promote that. Then in the second half of the book, I talk about why anarcho-capitalism would be better than a governmental system.
Okay, great. I mean, I've noticed that, because that's one way that I try to motivate stuff is I say, well, let me tell you what I recently said in a talk, and you tell me if you agree with this. I said that there's actually, you know, at least two different flavors of anarchism. And I said, one type, people who are attracted to it, it's people who don't want rules at all. Hey, no one's telling me what to do. I don't believe in gods or rulers. I don't want any rules. And they could be anarchists. But I said, also, there's another flavor where they take the rules so seriously. They're saying, yeah, everyone should be bound by these rules, even soldiers. And, you know, I can't force someone to come work at my business. So how come I can go be picked for jury duty? That would be slavery if some other business tried to do that. Why do they get to do that? And so are you okay with that approach to try to get people like to just start thinking, huh, that is kind of weird.
Yeah. So I'm the second kind of anarchist, I guess. there are moral principles. I don't understand why there should be a special group of people who are exempt from the rules. Right.
Yeah. Okay. And so, and like you, and I've seen other people come back and they think that this is like a very childish. So I'll tell you the kind of thing I've seen. Somebody would say something like, well, okay, yeah, but you guys are, I don't know if it's begging the question or raising the question, but to say, right, like I could say you're not allowed to ground your 8-year-old son because, you know, you can't go around grounding some other kids. So that would be kidnapping. So therefore no one, and then he said, no, but the point is it's your kid. And so you do have the authority to do that. And so you guys are just arguing in a big circle. You're saying, I don't think the state has the authority to do these things. And so therefore it doesn't have the authority to do these things, but you're kind of just, that's the whole issue under dispute.
Yeah. Maybe one thing you were raising there was, you know, parents have authority over their children. So you can tell the kid that he's grounded, but you can't do that to an adult. And,
to someone else's kid.
Yeah. Well, so the other issue is like, why are you different from the kid? Mm-hmm. And the other issue is, well, why are you different from another adult, you know, with respect to that kid?
Right.
Right. But, you know, the answer to the first thing is, well, you know, like adults have a lot more knowledge than children. Their mental capacities are not developed. Right. And also like the incentives are sort of okay because most parents care about their children and their children's welfare. And none of those things is true about the state with respect to ordinary citizens. Okay. So like the state is not genetically programmed to care for citizens who are not related to them. And also the state is not like of superior mental capacity. So, okay. And then,
but can I just stop for a second? But just to be clear. So you're okay in saying you're right. Your position is not that merely we're saying, if I were to go draft someone or tax someone or bomb somebody and have collateral damage, that would be bad for me. Therefore, the state can't do it. That's not your claim. You're saying, yeah, I'm willing to entertain theories as to why the state should have certain prerogatives that I lack. And then you say, but I've investigated all those claims and find them lack. So you agree it's just by you pointing out you're not allowed to do what the state's allowed to do is not the end of the argument.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the argument. Right. Okay. What that's supposed to do is establish that the defenders of authority need to give us some story, like,
right.
Well, just tell me why they have authority, right?
Right.
And so there are, I'm not saying there's no such thing as authority. So like, you know, if you go to work for a company, then your boss will have authority over you. And there's an explanation of why they have authority, right? Just because you signed a contract or whatever, right? And when you have kids, there's an explanation of why the parents have authority over the kids. There should be an explanation of why the state has authority over us if they do. Mm-hmm. And then, and people have given explanations, okay? But then when you investigate them, they just don't work out, right? Like often they have factual errors, or they just have like, you know, obvious moral errors that rely on moral principles that you wouldn't accept.
Okay, so maybe would it make sense to go through? So I think the average person would say, well, we have a democracy, that people have agreed to this system. And so what are you talking about? You know, we can change it in the next election if we don't like it. So what do you mean?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you can't change the system. You could maybe change the personnel, but you don't have that much choice. You know, you can choose between two people that you might not like. Okay. But anyway, I mean, so like, even if democracy was a lot better, like if you had a lot more options, it's unclear why you would get authority just by having a majority of people. Okay. And so remember that, you know, what needs to be explained is the state does things that would be considered rights violations if anyone else were to do them. Mm-hmm. So we need some kind of explanation for their authority that will explain why you would get to do things that would otherwise be rights violations. So like you need something that's sort of rights overriding. Okay, so does having a majority of people agree with you suffice to override what would ordinarily be people's natural rights? Right. So like, let's say, you know, we're out for dinner with a few friends. Okay. And at the end of the dinner, the question comes up of who's going to pay the bill. Right. And so like, you know, one of the diners says, you know, I think Mike Humor should pay for everyone. Right? And I go, no, I don't think so. I'm not going to agree to that. And then, you know, and then imagine you say, well, let's take a vote. Right. Mm-hmm. And then like three of the five people say, yeah, Mike Humor should pay for everyone. Am I now obligated to pay for everyone? Because there's more of them than there are of me. There's like a, you know, majority of people wanted that to happen. Okay. And now if I don't agree, then are they entitled to force me to pay? So could they like, you know, grab me and steal my money? Or if I refuse to pay, could they like kidnap me and lock me in a closet, you know, until I agree to pay? And it seems like the answer is no. So it seems like just having a majority doesn't suffice to override people's rights. Mm-hmm. Like, so there might be some cases where majority rule works, like if nobody has rights over something. So if some resources come down from heaven and then we have to decide what to do with them, so they don't already belong to anyone, they just like fell from the sky, then maybe democracy is a solution to how to distribute it. Mm-hmm. Right. But if I already have rights over some stuff, then, you know, democracy is not a solution to how to distribute it.
Okay. So again, with this stuff, you and I agree, I think, on 99% of the conclusions here. So I'm just pushing you for the benefit of the skeptical viewer, perhaps. Well, yeah. So what if somebody says, well, no, I can certainly imagine a scenario besides the fanciful one of stuff on, like with a corporation, you know, they have stockholder meetings and or shareholder meetings, and it's fine. You know, it's pretty standard that on certain issues, at least, you know, the shareholders vote in accordance with their shares of stock, not in terms of, you know, number of bodies. And, you know, you presumably don't have. So there the issue is, if you've kind of agreed on the front end, and so likewise, if there's a cruise liner that gets stranded on some Pacific island and there's 1,000 people just sitting around and they all form a government and they agree every once in a while we're going to have votes, but they've sort of ex ante agreed to this way of adjudicating things, and maybe they even have a constitution and say, now, yeah, you can't, you know, we can't vote to decide who you're going to marry or to take your kids from you unless there's these clearly specified, you know, case situations of abuse and blah, blah, blah. But in general, for public things, we agree ex ante that we're going to have votes to settle these and, you know, maybe higher thresholds for more important issues. And what if, in theory, every single person consented to that at the front end? You know, so what if they gave you something like that? How would you respond?
Yeah. So, you know, like you can establish authority through consent. Like if everybody consents to have this person tell them what to do, then you can establish authority. You know, too bad that never happened, right? So like that does happen with private companies. You know, everyone who's working for the company actually agreed and they actually signed a real contract. As in, there's a piece of paper with their signature on it that you could photograph and, you know, you can touch it. Okay. But you know, the way that actual world governments got established was not by a bunch of people all signing the contract. The way they got established was by, you know, as David Hume puts it, usurpation and conquest. That is, like in the history of every government, there's a time when, you know, either somebody took over the government, like in a coup, or somebody just like one tribe of people conquered another tribe or something like that. That's how government started.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they didn't start by literally everyone in the society agreeing to have one. And by the way, if you tried to do that, obviously you would never get an agreement.
Mm-mm.
I mean, so you could get a majority of people to agree to something. Like maybe a majority of people would agree to be ruled by Donald Trump, but there's no chance of getting unanimous agreement on anything that's useful. Right?
Okay. Yeah. So let me hit you from a different angle, because I've argued with these people, especially when I was in college and then grad school. I used to spend more time doing this. There's, I don't know how much you've interacted with like anarcho-socialists, and they think that term's redundant, that no, if you're an anarchist, you got to be a socialist, duh. And what if they would say, oh my gosh, you know, Professor Humor here, you're talking about because the workers signed a labor contract. Well, that's only because of the unjust distribution of so-called property titles, which itself was not due to consent going back eons. There was all kinds of bloodshed and conquest and violent expropriation. You know, people who are working the land, and then some outsiders came in and used in conjunction with the state to force them off, and now say, hey, we're the owners, we're the landed gentry, and da da da. So what are you talking about? The only reason the workers right now, quote, agree to these labor contracts is because of historical injustice that was certainly not consensual. So it's the same kind of thing. So would you respond to something like that?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of issues there. Yeah, okay. So, you know, one issue is how should we address historical injustices? You know, and you might say like every piece of property that exists today has like an unjust history behind it, right? Because like, you know, all of the land that's occupied was probably stolen at some time in history.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was passed down from there. And it doesn't matter what happened after that, whatever happened after that, it's not a legitimate title. And then all other material objects were created by taking resources from the land. So nobody owns anything. Okay. But, you know, like what conclusion is this supposed to lead to, right? Like this is supposed to lead to socialism. I don't see how. Like, right. So, you know, like the typical thing that people, I guess, conclude is, oh, that means that the state gets to just like take anything that it wants. But no, like that doesn't mean that the state owns anything, right? But so, you know, whatever the solution is to historical injustice is, it's not that somebody just gets to declare that now they can take anything and give it to anyone, right? Which is like what the state is doing. Okay, but then if you're an anarcho-socialist, I don't understand how that's supposed to be a solution to this. Like, so now what? So now the workers own everything? Like, how is that? They don't have a legitimate title either, right? But anyway, like the main problem I have with anarcho-socialism is, you know, well, there are many problems. But anyway, like one of the more obvious problems is, suppose that you establish the anarcho-socialist paradise. Suppose everything is, you know, just you wave a magic wand and suddenly everything gets to be just the way that the anarcho-socialists want. So all of the businesses are turned into worker cooperatives, I guess, right? Then, you know, the state disappears and like all of the capitalists have given up. Okay, then what happens? Well, then they would just convert it to a capitalist society, right? Because there are these workers who collectively own these businesses. Workers can sell their shares in the business. They can do that because there's no one to stop them from doing that because there's no government, right? And like the workers could just vote to do that. And why would they do that? Because if they sell their shares of the business, then they get money now and they eliminate risk, right? It's like if you're an owner of a business, then you're at risk of losing your stake because the business could fail, which frequently happens. So if you're risk averse or if you have time preference, you might want to sell your share of the business to somebody who has more risk tolerance or lower time preference. And there's no one to stop that from happening because you're in an anarchist society. So some workers would sell their shares and then some capitalists, so like people with lower time preference or whatever, would buy the shares, and then you just reestablish capitalism. Right? And so, like whatever the initial distribution is, you know, so like maybe there needs to be some redistribution to correct for the historical injustices. But after you did that, you would still wind up with capitalism.
Hey, folks, let's take a break from the action to talk about our sponsor for today, Monetary Metals. Now, we all know the dollar's losing value because of inflation. And we all know that owning gold protects your wealth from eroding away. But one of the biggest objections to owning gold is that it just sits there. There's no yield. It doesn't pay you any interest or dividends. In fact, you have to pay fees to store and insure it. But what if you could actually earn interest on gold? Well, that's exactly what Monetary Metals offers. With Monetary Metals, you can earn between 2% to 5% on your gold and silver every year. And if you're an accredited investor, you're eligible to earn even higher yields. But how does it work? How are they able to pay interest on gold? And let me say, folks, this part of their business model, it took me a bit to understand. After all, I thought, it's not like physical gold bars turn into more gold bars a year later. So how could they reliably promise you a return denominated in physical gold? Well, here's how it works. Monetary Metals connects you and your ounces with companies that need physical gold inventory for their business, such as jewelers, mints, refineries, bullion dealers, and more. The businesses need gold, and Monetary Metals lets you rent your gold to these qualified businesses. Now, in a more conventional arrangement, a jeweler, for example, might buy raw gold at its market price, fashion it into necklaces, rings, and so on, and then down the road sell the finished products. But this more conventional model involves risk for the jeweler, because the price of gold can drop in the interim, meaning they won't be able to sell the necklaces, rings, and so on for what they originally forecasted. If they had relied on a loan, quoted in dollars, to finance their initial purchase of the raw gold, they might be unable to pay back their creditors. But with Monetary Metals on the scene, there's another option. Now these businesses get the gold they need to use in their own business without being exposed to gold price risk. The jeweler, for example, borrows the raw gold at the start and promises a markup in physical gold. Then, no matter what happens to the spot price of gold, the jeweler's built-in margin from transforming raw gold into earrings, rings, and so on kicks in and allows him to pay back his loan after the final sale. The jeweler benefits, and you get to put your gold to work for a regularly monthly income in gold. It's a win-win. Now, when I say interest on gold, paid in gold, I mean it. It's actually paid in ounces of gold. For example, let's say you start out with 100 ounces and the interest rate is 3% annual. That means you will be earning 3 additional ounces of gold every year, regardless of what the spot price of gold does during the year. You just watch your total gold ounces grow every month and leverage the power of compound interest, but measured in ounces of physical gold and silver. So let's recap. Why would you earn interest in dollars, which are constantly losing value, when you can earn interest in gold? Go to www.monetary-metals.com/Murphy to learn more or to get started opening an account. In case you're wondering, I've opened an account with them myself, and my gold is now growing more gold at Monetary Metals. So again, go to monetary-metals.com/Murphy to get started growing your gold too. Okay, let's get back to the show. So I guess what maybe one, well, is there another like popular, maybe not so much for like the, what the layperson would say, but like in the, in this literature of political philosophy, I guess, is that the term I want to use? What other, besides just saying like the contract theory of government or social contract, like are there other popular justifications for why political authority is legitimate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a few things. I mean, so, you know, you hit the two most popular things that people appeal to: democracy, and then they appeal to the social contract theory. Mm-hmm. The third most popular thing is people just talk about how useful the government is. And so, you know, most people think that anarchy would be a complete disaster and it would just be like people killing each other in the streets and, mm-hmm. you know, eating each other or whatever.
Or we'd get invaded by a neighbor that had a government and they would just take us over. So we're getting a government yeah. away. Might as well be ours.
Yeah. Then, you know, you wind up under a dictatorship, mm-hmm. you know, which is worse than the current system. So, So, you know, they point out that government is really useful. And then that is somehow supposed to lead to their authority. Okay. So like, here's an analogy. We're all sitting on a life raft and the life raft is taking on water and it needs to be bailed out. And, for some reason, you know, most of the passengers are not doing it. Right. And like, you could just, you tell them, look, hey, we need to bail out the water or we're all going to die. Mm-hmm. And they're still just sitting around. So you take out your gun and point it at them and say, bail out the fucking raft. Okay. And then, you know, and then they bail out the raft and everybody survives. Okay. So now that's supposed to be analogous to government. Mm-hmm. Right? So like the government is the guy with the gun. and they're forcing people to do what's necessary to prevent the complete disaster for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems justified. All right. Sound good? All right. So like, you know, okay. So that's sort of supposed to be a defense of authority. Now, you know, what's the problem? There are a few features that political authority is supposed to have that this doesn't explain. Right. So, you know, imagine that the guy with the gun, after making people bail out the boat, he also says, oh, by the way, like, you know, you've got this like a diamond necklace. I want it. And then, you know, just takes it away. Mm-hmm. And then like, hey, I'm going to give it to another passenger. And then, hey, you know, you're drinking some alcohol there. That's not good for you. You know, I'm going to grab that. Okay. And then, you know, like there's this one passenger who the guy thinks is a little shady. And he says, hey, throw that guy overboard. They throw him overboard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, you know, is that all justified? No, none of that is justified. Okay. Well, all of that is also analogous to the stuff that the government does, right? And like, you know, having authority means that they get to do a bunch of stuff that they decide, right? Because they decided that these things should be done. They get to do them even if they're not objectively necessary, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's part of the inherent common sense notion of authority, right?
Well,
but there's no good explanation of why you would get to do those things.
Okay, so again, here, just pushing you to try to get exactly what your position is. So I can imagine some people saying, you're right. Some of the more sweeping visions of what the government or the state ought to do are completely unjustifiable for the reasons you're citing. But what about like reading like a Bastiat or a Thomas Paine or even a Ludwig von Mises? Where they're coming from is there are some core functions that they thought the government has to do. And like the way Bastiat certainly would ground it is just people starting with their natural right of self-defense, and they just cede that to a group that's more capable of enforcing it or protecting it or validating those rights. And then, you know, that raises some issue of taxation. And then I think like somebody like a Mises would just say, right, it's a thorny problem, but the government needs revenue. And so, yes, given that the government is absolutely essential to provide courts and police for property right protection and then to repel foreign invasion from outside armies, you need some revenue to do that. And yes, you got to have some taxation. But beyond that, no, the government shouldn't go beyond those bounds, and it shouldn't tax for redistributive purposes or social. It should just be the bare minimum, you know, to fund these necessary functions. And you know, you can wring your hands all you want, but if it doesn't do that, you're going to collapse or be taken over anyway. So it's kind of a silly argument.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, if it really were the case that people are sitting around and the raft is sinking and someone had to pull a gun to get him to do it, yes, that would be justified. And then if the guy got drunk with power and started abusing it, you could say you're not justified in doing that, but you were justified in pulling the gun to get us to bail the water out. And if someone wants to argue, no gun ever, then we would all be dead right now because we would have drowned.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there are two parts to my book and, you know, to the overall argument, right? And so the first is about the authority of the state. And, you know, the second is about how anarcho-capitalism would work better.
Mm-hmm.
So just the notion of authority, as I understand it, is that the state is entitled to do a bunch of stuff that would otherwise be rights violations. And they don't have to justify everything that they do. Like, they're entitled to enforce laws, even the laws that are not, in fact, good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, some people refer to this as content independence. That is, they get to enforce the law, and it's not dependent on the specific content of the law. Okay, so, and just like to maybe convince yourself that this is part of the notion of authority. The notion of having authority is the notion of being above the other people in a certain sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like you get to command them. Okay, and the guy in the life raft doesn't in fact get any authority. So like anybody, so if the life raft is in danger of going under and everyone is going to drown, then anyone has the right to force people to bail out water or do what it takes to get the boat bailed out. So after that guy, you know, the one guy forces everyone to bail out water, that doesn't prevent anyone else from forcing people to bail out water. That doesn't prevent anyone else from forcing him to bail out water. the guy who's forcing other people, you can also force him to bail out the water. Mm-hmm. Right. And also it doesn't give him the entitlement to just make rules just because he thinks it's a good idea, right? To, you know, to make rules that are not objectively necessary, right? So like there's no sense in which that guy now has a superior moral status to anyone else, right? And so he doesn't in fact get authority. Okay. And so now in, you know, in the first part of the book, I argue that, well, so if the government doesn't have authority, then the result of that is libertarianism. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the libertarian philosophy is just that the government shouldn't do any of the things that we wouldn't want anyone else to do. Now, if you're a minimal state libertarian, then you think it's okay for the government to do certain things, but those are only the things that would be okay for anyone else to do. So the government can stop, they can prohibit murder and theft, mm-hmm. right? But also, like, that doesn't give them a superior moral position to anyone else. Like, anyone has the right to stop murderers and thieves. Right. Or, you know, so I think.
Right.
Right. Okay. And then, you know, so like by rejecting authority, you're supposed to get to, you know, libertarianism, at least minimal state libertarianism. And in order to get to anarchism, then you need to realize that actually the state isn't necessary to prevent the breakdown of social order, right? Which is, you know, a longer argument, which, you know, I know you're familiar with, but yeah. You just have to make the argument that there's another way of having social order.
Yeah. So, I mean, even there, when I was trying to steel man it and presented the views of like a Thomas Paine or a Bastiat or a Mises, a critical link in their claim was that we need something, what we call the state or the government, to provide police protection and courts and a military, because otherwise, you know, it's game over. And so that's part. So it's almost like a, I don't know, technological is not the right word, but. But yeah, it's just a theory of how the world works that's an empirical fact, maybe, that they were just mistaken about. And so, yeah, you can just show them that, no, just like if they thought for whatever reason that only the state could teach kids how to spell, you might say, so therefore we need public schools, because otherwise without people knowing how to spell, what are you going to do? And then to just say, well, but no, you could have private education. Well, then that would be kind of important. If someone really believed only kids could only learn how to spell through state-sponsored teachers, that would be, you know, in our view, erroneous view that would color their view of political authority. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just like think about the socialist societies, right? Where they thought the state should provide everything, all goods. Mm-hmm. Right. How did that work out? That didn't work out very well. And so, you know, like in, well, there are some areas in our society where goods are just standardly provided by the market only. Then there are some cases where the market and the state provides them, like there are private schools and there are public schools. And then there are cases, things that are only done by the government. Okay. The things that are provided by the market, like we know that the market is better because we can compare our society to the socialist countries. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean the actually socialist countries.
Right, right.
where the government actually controlled all capital. Not the quote socialist countries where there's still private ownership of capital.
Right, right, right.
Like, okay. Anyway.
Scandinavian, like welfare state kind of thing that people call socialism. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. Private people are still running the companies. So, okay. Anyway. So like it works out better when the private people run the companies. Okay. And then what about cases where like in our society, we still have, you know, both government and private actors providing a thing like education. Well, there, the private schools are generally considered to be better. Mm-hmm. Right. Or, you know, you have UPS versus the post office and most people think UPS is better. Mm-hmm. And so, okay. And then you come to these things that we haven't tried private provision of, like, you know, police protection. Well, I mean, you know, why would you think that in these areas where we only have the government doing it, these are the only areas where actually government provision is better than private provision.
Right. And what's funny is it's not like the leftist progressives in the United States are very happy with the police in general. Like, no, they think that that's a terrible institution, you know, riddled with racism and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
Go ahead.
You know, and like the progressives are largely mistaken. Right? That is, the police are not as racist as they're saying, but they do periodically kill people. And in America, they kill people more often, you know, than the police in other countries. You know any private company that does that? Do you ever hear any cases of security guard brutality, like private security guards just beating it out of people? Or just, or, you know, like killing unarmed people? I don't hear any of those stories. Why is that? Because there's competition and they will lose business to their competitors who don't kill people unnecessarily, right?
Yeah.
But the police can keep doing that and they can keep their jobs because they're paid by the government, by tax money. So you don't have any choice but to pay them.
And the public too, if, you know, when people post videos of some cop clearly, you know, using excessive force, was like, oh, well, next time someone's breaking into your house, I guess you're just going to, you know, call the pizza guy, huh? You're saying if it's private security, you know, if you get food poisoning at Wendy's and you complain about it, no one's going to say, oh, well, next time you're hungry, I guess you're just going to go eat a plant. Like, no, you, I'm allowed to be mad at a, you know, particular company. It's not that it's all food, yes
eat
or
a
no.
Plant, but,
well, sure. Yeah, some people, I should eat a rock. How's that? okay, so can I, just with the time here, so I want to hit two things. So just to have you know, Michael, I'm thinking in terms of like transition, so we'll hit that. And then the last thing I'd like to do is just to see how does your approach differ? Like, I know you rely on intuitionism, and just to see how does that differ from like a standard Rothbardian approach, if that's okay, if we can do that. So first, someone might say, okay, yeah, I get what you're saying, but what does that mean in practice? Suppose most people reading can say, nobody likes the government the way it is right now, but if we all just tried to be anarchists next Thursday, it would be worse than it is right now. And so what do you propose we actually do about it in the meantime?
Yeah. So, you know, we need to make a gradual transition. And like the first step should be, well, the government should start outsourcing some of its, so-called minimal state activities. Mm-hmm. So they should start outsourcing the policing, meaning get private security guards to provide security instead of the government police. Individual neighborhoods or even individual apartment buildings should choose the security guard company. There has to be competition, right? And just to be clear, because I don't know, sometimes people misunderstand this, like I'm not saying like private company automatically good, right? Like mm-hmm. if you give a monopoly to a private company, then they're going to act, you know, like monopolies, like they're going to be assholes. Okay. So the key difference isn't like, oh, is it government versus private? The key difference is monopoly versus competition. The problem with the government police is they're a monopoly. Okay. So, you know, we need to get like just individual small areas to choose their own security guard companies where there should be multiple different security guard companies. And then, you know, just like get them to do more and more of the job and shrink the police departments. Okay.
Okay. So that's interesting. Just to be clear though. So you actually think that's something that should be at the front of the list as opposed to, oh, well, first let's roll back the like stuff that's violating the U.S. Constitution. That's easy. And then maybe down the road, we'll start getting even more radical and privatizing the police. Like you think start privatizing the police right away?
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly what the priority is, but like, you know, these things are not in competition, right? You know, mm-hmm. we can deregulate business and also start privatizing the police at the same time. Mm-hmm. Probably wouldn't. You know, neither of them would probably make it harder to do the other one. You know, the other thing is, but you know, I'm saying this because, like, you know, a bunch of people could easily see how you could cut back regulations, but don't see how you could do away with the police. Right. And so, just trying to explain how you could go further than people realize. Right.
Right.
And then, you know,
well, can I ask you just on that? You might remember a few years ago, like the defund the police was real big, particularly like on the left.
I remember.
Were you on board with, like, were you trying to just steer them in the right direction? Or because a lot of people, even like a lot of Rothbardians I know, were like, oh, yeah, a bunch of pinkos. Yeah. And I didn't take that tag. Well, I did like point to my work and say, hey, if you guys are serious, here's, you know, I've written on this. This is how you could actually defund the government police.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, did you try to latch onto that and do anything with it? Or?
Well, I mean, you know, I was saying, hey, why don't we privatize them? Privatize the system. Like, I don't know exactly what the defund the police people meant. I mean, like, it sounded like maybe they thought, yeah, we'll just like cancel that and have no security.
Right.
Like, what are you thinking? Right. But, you know, I did try to get some mileage out of it in favor of privatization. I don't know if anyone listened to me, you know.
Well, but what's interesting too is with some of that things too, I would try to push it and say, if we can just agree that we're not going to have, you know, state-run police agencies like in Chicago, then that's really all you would need, because whether they're for private police or not, if, in other words, how would the state stop companies from going in and, you know, sending guys with body armor and stuff to be private police enforcement if there's no Chicago PD to arrest those guys and say, you can't do that. We're the cops. So it is a little bit like, even it doesn't really matter what our visions are. If we could agree. And in practice, I think, you know, this, Michael, like some of them, when they said defund the police, all they really meant was reduce the police budget slightly to free up money for, like, you know, social service spending. They didn't actually mean disband the police because we still want to be in charge. If somebody's doing something we don't like, we do want to send the cops in to shut them down. So we need the police.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some people were saying we just meant to reduce their budgets. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then there were other people who were saying, no, we mean literally abolish the police. There was a New York Times opinion piece with that title. Uh-huh. Yes, we mean literally abolish the police. I don't think this transition could occur immediately. Like, I think because you need to build up the alternative institutions at the same time that you're reducing the existing ones. Mm-hmm. If the government institution just disappeared, like the police just immediately disappeared, then there would be total chaos. We need to have this thing where, like, you know, we start offering, you know, maybe contracts for private security guards to do security in this particular area. And so that, you know, they build up their capacity and their experience in doing the job, right? A related thing is, you know, we need to privatize the court system. So there are private arbitration firms, which you can go to now if you can get the other party you have a dispute with to agree, you know, to go to private arbitration. And I think the government court should just start referring more and more cases to private arbitrators. Mm-hmm. You know, like initially the government would probably, like, they'd have a list of private arbitrators that operate in this area. And then they would, like, you know, somebody tries to file a lawsuit, they would go, hey, here's a list of private arbitrators. You guys agree on one of them, right? And then maybe they could just have more and more cases handled that way. And, you know, I think even criminal cases should be handled by private arbitrators. Right. Because, you know, every court case is, in a sense, a dispute. Like, mm-hmm. there's a dispute between a plaintiff and a defendant, or if somebody's accused of a crime and they claim they didn't do it, then there's a dispute between whoever accused them and, you know, the person who's saying they didn't do it. So, you know, and then, you know, they should agree on a private arbitrator to go to. Right. And then, so, like, eventually you could have the police and the courts privatized. Right. And then there's not that much left of the government then. Then there's the legislature. Right. And then, you know, and basically I think that the legislative law should be replaced with common law. Mm-hmm. So, you know, which is judge made law, which, you know, but, you know, just for the audience, laws made by judges making decisions in cases where people had a dispute. And so the judge gives a decision, then he gives his rationale for the decision. And then that rationale becomes a precedent for future cases. And so it becomes a kind of law.
Out of curiosity, I know when I was looking at this stuff years ago, when I stumbled upon the distinction between law and legislation, like, I know Hayek stressed that, and that it, even the, to say, like, in earlier societies, they believed in law, but they thought they discovered it. Like, it wasn't that the political rule, like the rulers of the tribe or whatever could declare murder to be wrong. It's no, murder was illegal. It was a crime and they could enforce it, but it wasn't like it was illegal because the people in charge said so. Like, they viewed it as, and it was only, like, more modern with the hubris of, you know, man and the Enlightenment. I don't know if it was the Enlightenment, but to say, to think that, oh, we can, like, that's what legislation was in that distinction. So is that something you hang your hat on, that distinction? Or is that not really valid?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a distinction between different kinds of law. I mean, so there's statutory law versus common law. Mm-hmm. And common law, I just think, is usually superior. It's more subtle and more responsive to the actual needs of people. Like, it's more responsive to what actually happens in real cases. And it's less susceptible to being taken over by special interest groups. Right? Because, like, you know, statutory law, well, special interest groups can go to Washington and try to influence the statutes and, like, try to get the congressman to, you know, make laws that favor their company against their competitors and so on. And, like, it's really hard to change common law, right? Because you don't have a group of people who are sitting there just all day trying to think of a rule to make to impose on everyone, right? The judge can only do anything if somebody brings a case to him, and then he can only rule on that case. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so there's less potential for abuse, right?
Right, right.
You know, like, I mean, what you mentioned was sort of the natural law tradition. So, like, I believe there are there are objective moral principles. So there are things that are objectively wrong. I don't think that's the same as the law.
Okay.
But in previous centuries, people used the word law in a way that was maybe ambiguous, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe it was like a combination of these things, the things that are like the correct moral principles and the social conventions, right? Okay. But anyway, just within laws that are created by people, there is this distinction between the judge made and the legislator made. And like, I don't think we need the legislators.
Okay. Okay. I see what you're saying. Okay. So why don't we now just transition? We got like about 10 minutes left. So I think maybe you just hinted at it a little bit. So in a standard Rothbardian vein, it's, hey, you know, we can use our armchair reasoning, which isn't to disparage. You can use armchair reasoning to come up with the Pythagorean theorem, to come up with, you know, some elements or the structure, some key tenets, at least features of what the law would look like in a just free society. We can call it libertarianism, flowing from the non-aggression principle, for example, and homesteading and things like that. And that's kind of the superstructure of what the law code would look like in a free society. And yes, there's a role for judges in going and applying it to specific cases, but you know, we can sit there and bang out treatises on what a just legal code would look like. Am I right? Do you disagree with that? Or are you just saying that's not even, you don't need that for the case you're making?
Oh, well, yeah. So, I mean, like, I think people have a natural ability to sense what's objectively right and wrong, mm-hmm. although they make a lot of mistakes about it. Right now, I mean, the defense of anarcho-capitalism, I think you can make the case just using natural human selfishness. Like, I don't think you have to assume that everybody is altruistic or like super moral or whatever, mm-hmm. right? Because, and you know, that's good because it's going to be unstable if it depends upon high levels of morality. People have a sense of morality, but their moral motivation is weak.
Okay.
And their motivation to promote their own interests is stronger. But fortunately, in the anarcho-capitalist system, you know, there are mostly incentives to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, okay. Now, you could have a situation where like the society has incorrect values. And so then, you know, and then the anarcho-capitalist system winds up with the incorrect rules, right? Because like the private arbitrators are going to try to make decisions that will look fair to third-party observers. And that's because they want to maintain their reputation. But what looks good to third-party observers depends upon what the values of the society are. So if the society has bad values, okay. But, you know, obviously the same is true of democracies. The same is true of any society. If society has incorrect values, then you're screwed, right?
Okay, yeah. So I'm partly here I'm relying because I had read David Gordon's review of your book, and he was focusing a lot, I mean, because that's where he's coming from, was focusing a lot on that you were like positing a sort of moral intuitionism, which it sounded like you just alluded to. So are you setting that up as a like, hey, if we want to start trying to convince the average American that their notion of the state is really misguided and that, you know, if I can work with you and teach you some economics and blah, 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 maybe in a year you'll be call yourself an anarcho-capitalist. Is your point that I don't need to get into fancy theories of morality? All I got to do is appeal to stuff like murder and theft and, you know, rape are wrong. Yeah. And if you grant that, then, you know, I can kind of lead you to the path to anarcho-capitalism.
Well, so I think you can get to libertarianism from common sense morality.
Okay.
But I think you can't get all the way to anarcho-capitalism without like talking about the economic stuff,
sure,
and like
right.
how the system mm-hmm. would work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because so, you know, like even if it's sort of, a rights violation for the state to like steal our money, if that's the only way to prevent a complete breakdown of society, then that's still what they have to do. Right. So it's sort of like, you know, if you have to steal some bread in order to survive, it's a rights violation, but you still got to do it. Okay. Right? Mm. So, and you know, like complete breakdown of social order is bad enough that it would justify stealing money. Okay. So you really need like the arguments about how anarcho-capitalism would actually work better in order to get rid of the minimal state. Right.
Okay. So can I use it just to continue that analogy? So is it something like this, that you're out with your buddy in the woods somewhere and you got lost and you've been wandering for a few days and your stomach's really growling and maybe there was a stream, so you've been able to drink, so you're not dying of thirst. And then you see some guy's cabin that's all locked up for the season because the guy's not there.
Yeah.
And your buddy's saying, look, I know it's breaking and entering, but what are we going to, we're going to die. We got to break in this and maybe we'll leave him a note and try to find him later and pay him back, but we got to steal. And then, you know, you can sit there and argue philosophy with him, but if you see like, oh wait, no, there's an apple tree over there. Let's go eat some apples first and reassess. Yeah. Like that's really the thing to, you know, so is it something like, am I, do you get where I'm coming from? Like, is that kind of what you're doing vis-a-vis people in their view of the state that, yeah, I can sit there and convince them that there's a sense in which taxation is theft and they can agree. But if they think we're all going to die without it, it doesn't, you know, I got to give them an alternative and then they'll be more receptive to my philosophical arguments.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. So, I mean, like, you know, part of what you were saying was maybe a psychological point, like you're just not going to convince people to like commit suicide, you know, like they're not going to like, or just like, you know, give up all of the goods of modern society, you know, in order to respect rights. But there's also the moral point, which is, well, they shouldn't. No, they shouldn't give up all the goods of modern society, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like property rights aren't absolute. You could be justified in stealing something in order to save your life. You could be justified, you know, so you could be, so therefore the state could be justified in stealing some money in order to prevent this complete breakdown of social order, which would cause a lot of people to die, right? And yeah.
Okay. So I suppose maybe in the last few minutes here, we got, what is the reception? I'm just curious, like when you've been putting these arguments out and you interact with other political philosophers, is what, I mean, do they just think you're wrong or what's sort of like, yeah, you're right. But you know, you haven't sold me on the technological feasibility of anarcho-capitalism.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly. So like the book has been cited many times, but I haven't read most of the things that are citing it, so I don't know what they said. But the way the academic world works is like most citations are perfunctory. It's right. Like they're just mentioning there's somebody who said P, and then there's a citation, right? So like, you know, so it might be that a bunch of people are saying, you know, there's some like crazy anarchists out there. Footnote humor, 2012. But let's assume that that's wrong.
Let me put it to this way. Like my understanding isn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but like Robert Nozick, people didn't dismiss him as some, you know, hippy dippy guy. Like he was taken seriously and people felt they had to grapple with his, I mean, he didn't turn everyone into a radical libertarian, but they felt they had to grapple with him. So I'm saying, you know, even people who disagree with you, like, do they realize that, there's some serious issues here that we got to think through?
Yeah, I think that's right. So like skepticism about authority is actually a widely held view in political philosophy.
Okay.
And that is not just due to me, but like, you know, a couple decades ago, John Simmons had this book about how you don't have political obligations, right? Which means like you don't have to obey the law just because it's the law. And I think that might be the majority opinion now in political philosophy. Right. And now, but I think that most people didn't realize that that leads to libertarianism. So, you know, so I was hoping to push people further. Okay. I don't think that people have accepted libertarianism, but I think it has been received seriously. I do have like, I did a debate volume. Right. Wait, let me see. I can show this. I did a debate about, you know, political authority is an illusion with Daniel Lehman, who's a contemporary political philosopher. So, you know, and it's from Rutledge, which is, you know, it's pretty good. So, you know, people are thinking about it. But I think, like, not that many people are convinced. So they're like, just, like, still desperately trying to find some way that the state could be justified, right? You know, because, I don't know, maybe because of status quo bias.
Are you familiar in economics with, like, Arrows and Possibility Theorem? Does that mean anything to you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay. So that just where it sounds like what you're talking about is, so in economic, I'm saying this for the listener, that, you know, Kenneth Arrow, one of, I think it might've been his PhD thesis. I'm not sure about that, but he was doing stuff on like social choice theory and, you know, and it, like there was a problem of mapping, you know, individual preferences over various possible things. Then how do you map that into like a quote general social welfare ordering? And he wanted to just, so the story goes, I don't know if this is true, but this is the way I was taught to me. That he was just trying to rule out some stupid ones. Like, obviously, if every single person in society thinks X is better than Y, the social welfare ordering should think that too. It shouldn't think Y is better than X. That would be stupid. So he just started coming with some pretty basic, you know, transitivity, stuff like that, real basic things. And he says, just to winnow it down to a manageable set of, you know, plausible social welfare rankings. And he ended up with the empty set. And then he went, oh, and he published that, and look at that. And so you would think that would be like a literature ender, that that would just be boom. And instead, the economists who were interventionists were just like, oh, yeah, okay. And then they just worked around it and came up with, well, if we assume that preferences have this feature, then blah, 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 blah. And it was like nothing happened. And I was like, are you kidding me? So anyway, I'm just wondering, is like that you can drop a bomb and, you know, rhetorically or intellectually and show that, yeah, there's been no valid justification of the state to date. And they can be like, yeah, huh, that's funny. So anyway, I think the top capital gains rate should be 47% because.
Yeah. Well, you know, like, I guess my view is perceived as being, you know, sufficiently radical that. And there's a lot of stuff in philosophy that's like this, where there's some like radical view, but it has a surprisingly good argument. You can't figure out what's wrong with it, but you just have to go on with life.
Yes.
Right. So I think that's their attitude. Like, wow, there's this Humor who's got this crazy idea. I don't know what's wrong with it, but man, you know, we can't go that far. There's got to be something wrong with it. So anyway, let's just go on.
Yeah.
You know, like that. Anyway, and I don't have a theorem like Arrows and Possibilities.
Right.
I just have responses to views that people have put forward. So maybe they can find another view, right? You know, the Arrow and Possibility theorem, by the way, though, like, I don't think it's that big a deal. So I think, like, so if you're like a, you know, a smart interventionist, I think you'd be a utilitarian. And you just say, well, you just have to incorporate everybody's cardinal utilities and you just have to add them together. And then, you know, you get the preference ordering based on the total utility, right? And, you know, you can't prove that there's not that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you certainly could do that. I mean, in other veins, though, like in terms of standard utility theory, economists were trying to see how much can we build up without relying on the assumption of cardinal utility. So I'm just saying this was not the way economists wanted to be modeling stuff. But because they realized, I'll put it to you this way. I see all kinds of people talking about the welfare theorems and to say, oh, so market allocations are not optimal because look at they don't. So I'm saying when the result proves, you know, what they like, then, oh, they hold it up and, hey, you know, we'd love markets, but look at all the ways markets fail because this model says so. But to say, no matter what, you're never going to get, you know, a valid way to transmit individual rankings to a social welfare ordering that just, so what? You know, anyway, I realize we're kind of saying the same thing. Okay, well, I get what you mean too, that, yeah, you're not like proving no such justification could exist even in principle. You're just kind of saying, to date, you know, somebody show me a good justification because I don't think there is one. And one might think that would bother people that, let's try to meet this guy's challenge. But yet I'm wondering if they actually don't care. I guess really what I was wondering is, do they basically say, this is kind of a fool's errand. There's all kinds of areas where we can't justify stuff, but we still move on with our lives. Or do they say, oh, you know, he set up a straw man. Clearly, this is the way you justify the state, and Humer's just wrong, and he hasn't knocked this argument down. Duh.
Yeah. I don't think anyone says the second thing.
Okay.
Yeah, So there are probably people out there who are trying to develop new theories. Like, there's always somebody coming up with some new, more complicated, more convoluted theory.
Right.
And then they'll like put forward some moral principle that's more complicated or more subtle than things that were said before. And you're like, oh, why should we believe that moral principle? And then they'll be like, I don't know, because it gives us the right results, like that the state has authority.
Right.
Something like that. And they'll say, I don't know, it seems kind of vaguely plausible. So, right. And then like I have to try to modify my arguments to show why that's not correct.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. Nobody says that I'm attacking a straw man because it's not.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I need to wrap up there. So the book is The Problem, Political Authority. Michael, if people want to hear, so if you're watching the video, folks, you can see he's holding it up. If people want to see more of your thoughts and, you know, how you tick, where should they go?
So I have a blog called Fake News on Substack, FAKENOUS on Substack. And, I have a website. Also, I've got like 10 books, which you can get on Amazon.
Okay, great. So, folks, this is bobmurphyshow.com/320, and I'll put some links, you know, Michael, offline. You guys send me the ones you want me to promote. We can do that. Okay, well, Michael, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.